as Palestinians in the blockaded territory. In one of the latest attacks, 7 civilians were killed after Israeli bombing west of the radio and television building in Tal al-Hawa. Tal al-Hawa neighborhood of Gaza City. Earlier, over a dozen people, including children, were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed a residential building northwest of Gaza City. Multiple fatalities were also reported after a separate strike targeted an apartment building in the same area. An Israeli strike targeting tens of displaced Palestinians west of Gaza City was also deadly, with several fatalities. Israeli forces also opened fire on Palestinians seeking aid in different parts of Gaza, killing more than 30 hungry civilians. The U.S.-Israeli genocide, which began in October 2023, has so far killed more than 59,100 Palestinians, leaving over 142,500 others injured. Most of the victims are women and children. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier with more details on the latest Israeli attacks across the blockaded territory.
As you know, those attacks are still maintained with the same brutality since the very beginning of this genocidal war till this moment, and particularly when it comes to Deir el-Balah city, which is still, as you know, subjected to this ongoing military offensive that targets the southern outskirts of Deir el-Balah city. Every moment we can hear several bombardments booming, and those are targeting more residential buildings in addition to the artillery strikes, which are still ongoing and abated. The current situation is still very tragic and precarious for the Palestinian families in Deir el-Balah city, amid the rising fears and concerns among the people here that the Israeli occupation forces are going to expand their attacks to include and target more residential areas in Deir el-Balah, and which is absolutely overwhelmed with hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian displaced who are still taking shelter in Deir el-Balah city, and they are still exposed to more brutal air strikes and attacks. And to be honest, over the past couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes launched several air strikes targeting more residential buildings. So we are talking about at least 30 Palestinian civilians, 30 Palestinian residential buildings have been targeted and destroyed in Deir el-Balah city alone in less than 48 hours since the onset of this brutal ground offensive that targets Deir el-Balah city.
The UN Secretary General has issued a serious warning about the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in Gaza. Antonio Guterres described the war-torn territory's current condition as a horror show marked by mass devastation and starvation.
We need look no further than the horror show in Gaza, with a level of death and destruction without parallel in recent times. Malnourishment is soaring. Starvation is knocking on every door. And now we are seeing the last gasp of a humanitarian system built on humanitarian principles. This system is being denied the conditions to function, denied the space to deliver, denied the safety to save lives.
Addressing the UN Security Council, Guterres condemned the Israeli military aggression against Gaza and its continued restrictions on the delivery of humanitarian aid, including food, to its people. He said the situation in Gaza reflects a broader failure to uphold international obligations across the globe. Guterres warned that hunger and displacement in Gaza have reached record levels as the conflict intensifies and international law is repeatedly violated. He also denounced recent Israeli attacks on UN facilities, emphasizing that those premises must be protected under international humanitarian law. He urged all UN member states to uphold international law and reaffirm their commitment to peace. Author and journalist Sakina Dotu joined us earlier. She said a global uprising is crucial to pressure governments into taking meaningful action to stop the Gaza genocide.
Sanctions in all sorts of manners. You know, I am astounded, really, that people are just around the world are, sitting back and watching these kind of images. And, you know, there is a lot of power that people have. And this is something that, unfortunately, around the world, people don't seem to understand. For example, you know, I talk to women in Gaza on my show, and I find it so disturbing, you know, the images that are coming out. One of the things that women after women tell me is that the Arab and Muslim world is sending us shrouds continuously. That is all the help they are providing us. And shrouds are not needed for people who are martyred. And they do not need a shroud. They can be buried without it. They are not bothered about sending food, about sending medicines, about even making statements. So what are all these ordinary people in those countries doing? We are aware of the fact that, you know, they have dictatorial governments and it is difficult. But if they are not going to rise up, if they are not going to demand something of their governments, then when will they ever speak up? It really is very distressing to see not only that the people are starving there, but that the rest of the world is going about, you know, their daily lives as if there is nothing serious happening. It just boggles the mind, and it is really disturbing. It is one of the lowest points, I believe, in human history.
The leader of the Hezbollah movement has condemned the global silence on Israel's crimes in Gaza, calling for actual measures to stop the massacre of Palestinians and to besiege Palestinian territory. Sheikh Naim Qassem's remarks followed a joint statement by 25 countries, including some European states, calling for an immediate end to the Gaza war. Qassem said the call does not absolve those countries of their responsibility regarding what is happening in Gaza. He said such positions must be translated into actual measures to stop such crimes by imposing sanctions on Israel, isolating and prosecuting the regime, and stopping all forms of dealings with it. The Hezbollah chief also called on the Arab and Islamic countries to shoulder their responsibility, stop normalization with Israel, close the regime's embassies, and cut relations with Tel Aviv. Qassem described the U.S. Israeli atrocities in Gaza as excessive savagery, genocide, and starvation, which have exceeded all human and moral standards. Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned the continued killing of Palestinians in Gaza by Israel and the regime's strict ban on delivery of food, water, medicine, and other basic necessities to its defenseless people. The ministry also expressed deep concern over the worsening humanitarian catastrophe caused by the horrific crimes of the Israeli regime in the besieged Gaza Strip. It also called for urgent, effective, and decisive measures by international community and regional countries to stop the genocide in Gaza and alleviate the suffering of the oppressed Palestinian people. The ministry also criticized the UN Security Council for failing to fulfill its legal responsibilities regarding the aggression and crimes of the occupying regime. It slammed the all-out support of the West, especially the U.S., for Israel, saying it has not only granted the regime impunity, but also paved the way for even more severe crimes in Gaza. The ministry called on Islamic countries to force Israel's supporters, especially the U.S., to stop the regime's crimes, hold Israeli criminals accountable, and get humanitarian aid into Gaza. The UK public broadcaster, the BBC, continues to face outrage over its censorship of the Gaza genocide. Critics are using different mediums to raise awareness about the BBC bias and reignite fierce debate about Western media complicity in the ongoing genocide.
An image that speaks a thousand words. In the London Underground, an advert exposing the complicity of British media in the Gaza genocide. One of the topics up for discussion at a gathering in this Palestinian cultural center, with the BBC and other mainstream media outlets accused of providing lopsided coverage of Israel's genocidal war on the coastal enclave.
It comes across to me as having to speak on behalf of the state, whichever the state might be. And therefore, in doing that, it can't not say what is happening, but it says what's happening in such bland, neutral terms that it doesn't make any sense to the reality on the ground.
A reality highlighted by the Center for Media Monitoring in its recently published report detailing the deep-seated anti-Palestinian bias in the BBC's coverage of the Gaza genocide.
when the Center for Media Monitoring shows conclusively that they interview X amount more Israelis than they do Palestinians, they two-size the genocide by continuously showing the Israeli rebuttal. This is proof that they are not indeed impartial. And actually, this is a breach of their royal charter. This is what gives them the privilege to receive the UK license fee payers' money. So the fact that they are in continuous breach of that, yet nothing is happening, completely breaks down that facade.
I've heard you. You hear me. I understand you have your foreign policy. I understand you.
A facade also challenged by the likes of Egyptian journalist Rahma Zain. In her work and her fiery exchange with a CNN reporter in the region, in the early days of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Media is doing, it's gone off from telling the news to hiding the news. We're seeing people being starved to death, and the magnitude of that is not represented by media, purposely to not only sedate the people, but to further dehumanize us in the region. And by dehumanizing us, they can get away with brutalizing us.
Examples of what critics call a war on truth. The BBC's decision earlier this year to drop a documentary depicting unspeakable horrors faced by Gaza's medical workers. And before that, the shelving of another Gaza expose narrated by a 13-year-old Palestinian boy.
Here at Palestine House, a group of journalists and activists have gathered not only to lament and to grieve Britain's mainstream media's complicity and silence, but also to break it. If the media won't carry the truth they maintain, the people must. Saipur is up, London.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager during a military incursion into the town of the Gabatia near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. According to local sources, 16-year-old Ibrahim Majid Ali Nasr succumbed to a serious injury to his chest after he was shot by Israeli soldiers' live ammunition. The new fatality increased to 43, the number of Palestinians killed during the regime's ongoing military aggression against Jenin Governorate. Israeli forces and settlers have intensified crackdown on Palestinians in the West Bank since the outbreak of the regime's genocide on Gaza in October 2023. Since that time, nearly 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and around 7,000 others have been injured across the occupied territory. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News Bulletin. Thank you for being with us and goodbye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. When we think about Ashura and the events of Karbala, we're not just remembering a historical tragedy. We're connecting to something much deeper. Every year during Muharram and Safar, we see familiar scenes, black flags hanging in the streets, people carrying alams in the different majalis, voices reciting nohes and marsiyas, and even young children dressed as the little heroes of Karbala. But what do all these things really mean? Welcome to our program, The Viewpoint, your program on IRIB English Radio. أعظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بالحسين عليه السلام. May Allah increase your rewards for and توفيقات for mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions. I'm your humble host, Sayyid Ali, and it's an honor for us to be here today in this studio. I am joined with two dear brothers, Brother Sheikh Danish. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Welcome. Good to have you here again.
Thank you.
Azamallah wajuna wa wajurakum. Thank you so much for being here. And dear brother Sayyid Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Once again, I have the privilege to be here with you.
It's
and
a pleasure.
Azamallah wajuna wa wajurakum. So, dear brother Sheikh Danish, black and green flags are common during Muharram and people carrying them. What is the symbolic meaning of the black and green flags? Sometimes like red ones I have seen. And how do these colors influence the mood and purpose of mourning rituals?
Right. So regarding the black flags that are a symbol of mourning, right, and black clothes as well, and it's a symbol that has it's a symbol that has its roots from Arabia, of course. That during those times when a person's near and dear ones would be mourned, they would lose a relative, a near or dear one would be lost. They would venerate that person, or they would have rituals for that person in that form of by wearing black clothes. And this has been carried on during the centuries, and it has become a tradition. Mm-hmm. And the flag, of course, is a symbol of the flag bearer of Karbala, Hazrat Abu al-Fazl al-Abbas, who was the flag bearer of Karbala.
Exactly.
And he was basically in that time when two opposing armies were facing each other in battle,
mm-hmm.
they would have a flag bearer. And till the time that flag bearer was holding his ground, it meant that the armies were the two armies were fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
Once the flag bearer was martyred, another person would take the charge and would become the flag bearer. So a flag bearer was important in that sense.
Sure.
And so the green flags, as apparent, would symbolize the flag bearer, that is Hazrat Abu al-Fazl al-Abbas,
mm-hmm.
And the concept that we are carrying the flag of the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yeah.
That is, the fight against tyranny is being reflected in this age and time by these flag bearers who are carrying the flag of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam forward. And so these are some of the meanings and annotations attached to.
And I guess the green flags or the green sort of colorful dresses or customs in general, when we see in this theatrical performance or Shabi Khane, which we're going to talk about soon, represent Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and the family, the household of the Prophet in general. And the red ones stands for the enemy or the Bani Umayyad or Yazidi ones and people like that.
There is more to it, Brother Sayyid. The green flags, of course, as Sheikh mentioned, flags is to identify the side of the armies in battle. So mm-hmm. that's why when the flag is raised from one side, we know, okay, we are fighting with that side is belongs to this set of people and another flag. So these are identifications of the different sides
like
in their battle.
Logos.
Exactly. The black is because of mourning, is because of the martyrdom of Abd al-Hussein. That's why after the martyrdom of Abd al-Hussein, many of the Shias, they move towards wearing black clothes, putting black flags in front of their homes, identifying themselves with black to show that they're in the state of mourning,
mm-hmm.
until Banu al-Abbas hijacked that entire mission of mourning and the revenge for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. The green one has also two meanings. One is that green represents Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam. It was the Prophet's color. It is also easy on the eye, naturally speaking. And also, green also represents revenge as well.
Yeah.
Black represents mourning. Green represents revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So the Shias, the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, and this is not just to label ourselves to say whoever believes in Imam Ali, no. Whoever follows the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, we know. Even this encompasses again the orthodox Sunni brothers. So mm-hmm. when I mean the followers of Ahlul Bayt, I'm being very general over here. everyone believes that on the coming, on the arrival of the Imam of our time, and he will raise the flag for the revenge of Imam Ibn al-Hussein. That's something that is established. That's something that everybody believes. Mm-hmm. So the mourners of Abdul Aziz, they keep both the flags, one to say that we are mourning, the other to say that we are preparing ourselves for the great revenge from Abdul al-Hussein.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Dear Sheikh Danish, so when we walk into Takaya and Husseinia, these places during Muharram, it's not just a building we're entering. It feels like we step into a space filled with emotion, memory, shared faith. In history, recent history, people got killed there, martyred there by the attack of those people who cannot bear these majalis and ceremonies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. How do Takayas, these Takiyah, as we call it, Takiyah or Husseiniyah, or in some cases we've got Hassaniyah, Fatimiyah in different countries, go beyond being just physical spaces and places and halls and rooms, and they become powerful symbols of Shia identity? Can you talk about that?
Right. So in all the countries where the believers of Imam, the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, whether they be Sunnis or Shias, are existing, they hold different ceremonies for the commemoration of these events. And particularly Husseinias and Takayas and places have been, for example, categorized as the places of commemorating Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So we see a special respect that all the believers of this message have for these places. One is that these ceremonies that are being held are directly being held because of the commemoration ceremonies that were held by the Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And so we see those holding these ceremonies, those commemorating these ceremonies, those donating funds for these ceremonies as really doing the bidding of the Aima alayhimus salam.
Yeah.
And so this is a noble, sacred undertaking that they are doing. And more than that, so what we believe is that these ceremonies, these commemorations, they are directly being attended to by the Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salam. Mm-hmm. And what we have in different traditions and different ceremonies, that one khatib was told to go to a certain place,
exactly,
by the order of Lady Fatima to Zahra salamullah alayha.
Exactly.
And when that famous khatib goes to that place, only a single lady, old, yes, lady, has saved an entire year's savings to commemorate a mourning ceremony,
mm-hmm,
and only two or three ladies from the neighborhood are in attendance.
Yeah.
So the belief is that these ceremonies, even if they are held in a small place, in a small household, have a special attention by the Lady Fatima to Zahra salamullah alayha, by the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam and the Imam al-Zaman
alayhi salam. It's not about quantity, it's about quality,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's not about quantity. And when these majalis, these ceremonies are held in Husseinias, they become a symbol of the resistance, the symbol of the message, and directly the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam have an attention, and it is taking place by their auspices, by their permission.
And one of the well-known Husseinia to my mind is the Husseinia of Imam Khomeini, which Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the revolution, delivers lectures, and the whole world is waiting usually for his last points and, you know,
just
talks.
To give a little bit context on the Takaya itself, Takiyya. You see, Takiyya, one of the theories is that it comes from the word Takiyyagah or, mm-hmm, Takiyya, meaning that these are places where the A'imma and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, as mentioned in the Riwayat, that wherever there is majlis, there are always A'imma and Ahlul Bayt attending that majlis. And so Takiyya means that they are bracing somewhere in the corner of the majlis. So it's something that we should be very wary about. We should not take this lightly. That's number one. The second thing is that, you see, in the time of the noble prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, masjid and the Friday prayers held a very important significance.
Sure.
Because masjid was a place of gathering, a social gathering.
From the beginning of Islam.
Exactly. It's a place where marriages happen. It's a place where connections between networking between the Mu'mineen happened, and the Friday prayers is where the most important set of teachings of Islam, most important news, political affairs, and so on were discussed. But then after the hijacking of Islam, after the noble Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and unfortunately the Ma'sumeen and the A'imma and the Ahlul Bayt, they were hindered from entering into the masajid and taking the pulpits.
Mm.
And so therefore, especially after the martyrdom of Abdul al-Hussein, wherever the Ahlul Bayt saw opportunity, they took that opportunity and they took advantage of it and revived the message of Imam al-Hussein. Using the first one being the majlis of Lady Zainab in Karbala after the martyrdom, the crying, the weeping, the mourning.
Yeah.
And then one of the most significant and the early ones is the Majlis of Abu Abdul Hussein in the Syria, the Damascus itself, nearby the palace of Yazid,
yeah,
where the Usara, the captives of Abu Abdul Hussein were kept there. And so wherever there was opportunity, they took it. And throughout the history, because the followers of Ahlul Bayt and Ahlul Bayt were, somewhat away from the, they were kept away from the masjid, the hukama of the time, the rulers of the time, the tyrants of the time, they did not want to give them the pulpit,
yeah,
so that somehow it will be a revolution once again against them. So this concept of Husainiyya emerged away in a separate from masjid, although there is nothing that there is no reverence that lessens from the masjid. The masjid, yeah, has its own importance,
true,
its own ahkam, its own sharia, and so on. It's in its own place. Many of the masajid are Husainiyya themselves, right? But this concept of separate place of gathering for Husainiyya emerged among the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Yeah.
This Husainiyya can be within the home, true, or a specific place outside. As Sheikh Lanis mentioned, people gather in their homes. And again, this is because of the repressive rule of tyrannies along the history, whereby they would not allow social gatherings for Ahlul Bayt, so they would have it secretly in their homes. Mm. Even until now, we continue it,
yes,
symbolizing the time when the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam went through difficulties.
In some, right, of the countries right now, like the government, they don't
even until
people
now. That's why we, yeah, sometimes we need to take the context of these riwayat of the Azadari. Whenever there is mourning for Abdullah, those who attend, those who cry, Jannah becomes wajib. Why? Yeah. It's not because just our cry, our tears are so cheap. And no. It's because the time, the reviving of this message is not that easy.
And
it didn't come to us at an easy cost. We should not take the Islamic Republic of Iran for granted. We should not take many of the Husainiyas for granted, because these are the results of generations of blood, generation of sacrifice, not just one, overnight.
Mm.
We should not take this for granted. And so therefore, that's why Ahlul Bayt had an important, very strong extreme importance and extreme emphasis on making sure that these majalis happen in any form possible, whether it be in Husainiyya, in masjid, in homes, and so on.
Thank you so much, both of you guys. We have to wrap up this session, and let's just conclude the session by reciting one salam to Imam Hussein and his companion. As-salamu ala al-Hussein wa ala Ali ibn al-Hussein وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. May peace and blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala be upon Imam Hussein alayhi salam and Ali ibn al-Hussein alayhi salam and the rest of their families and companions. Till another episode, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaykum as-salamu alaykum.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept our
Diverse range of programs, youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Raising Good People. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and obviously Raising Good People. Raising good people is something that obviously in Islam we do both as parents, educators do this, or teachers, university professors. But in a sense, we're meant to be doing this no matter what our status is, no matter what our role is in society, because really, how do we raise good people? So we raise good people in a sense by ourselves being good. Because people, everyone will be, you know, we all look at each other. We all observe each other. So if we are observing someone else with good behavior, that has an impact on us. So that can help us to be raised as good people. And the other way of obviously raising people is to actually give specific instructions, advice, and guidance. So that's two aspects. I'm just going to first refer to a particular sorts of behaviors in the life of one of the most famous martyrs from Lahore Defense, Dr. Mustafa Chamoghan. So it's said again and again that his personality had very special effects on people around him. So for example, there was actually a group that came from the Lebanon to fight with Dr. Chamoghan in Iran during the Lahore Defense. And it's said that they all became martyrs, and nobody even found out who they were. But it's said, what is said about this particular group is they were just as humble as Dr. Chamoghan, and they were fighting only for the sake of God and duty. And then the comment that is added to that is that this is something that was happening with the people who sort of came and joined Dr. Chamoghan in whatever situation, whether this was fighting, whether this was working with him, that he was actually raising people like that. So people who, for example, were told, even if they were totally unknown, but they were indebted to God. Welcome back to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea of raising good people and how we raise good people. And obviously I've mentioned we can raise good people by being the best we can be, because, you know, we learn from observing others. And then the second way is to actually make, instruct, advise, and guide through words, for example, as well. And I've mentioned the example of Dr. Chamoghan, who in everything he did basically seemed to raise good people in many different ways. And obviously, so what's the lesson that we take from this? And obviously we, our martyrs, you know, obviously these, they have very high ranks. And obviously I'll just say again, we cannot ever think of our martyrs as dead. They are truly alive. And many people will actually say this, for especially the families of martyrs, they do even feel the presence of the martyrs. So be aware of that, that the martyrs are even if you visited them at their graves, grave sites, they are very much amongst us, and people even ask them for help. So the lesson is, so what do we do? So what can How can we follow this example of these sort of martyrs and trying to raise good people? And obviously I've mentioned that we need to also, first of all, focus on what we are doing, because in a sense, and the suspicion is some of these, many of our martyrs, they did not even necessarily give specific guidance. People were going to them and just watching them, just being in their company, and that was already changing them. So rather than, because obviously our tendency is, you know, we want to open our mouths and we want to speak and we want to say, and maybe we say it really beautifully, but is it really that important to always tell people do this and do that? Maybe we can also guide just through being the best kind of person we can be. And obviously there is people who manage to purify themselves, really focus on getting rid of flaws in their character. You know, there is, they do say that there is a special light, and people, if you manage to do that, other people will be drawn to you and they will gain huge benefit from being around you. So let's maybe just focus on that. Let's just focus on polishing, training our own character, first of all. So inshallah, these are, let's say, insights, reminders for all of us. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IRIB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
You're there. What? Good morning to all our listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. We start off this hour's program with our radio productions feature. After that, we have Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. Then it's time for Leaders' Speech. In this program, we air a selection of statements and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with Round the World with reporters. Reporters from all over the globe tell us what is happening in the corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands.
Nasser Khosrow Street is the oldest street in Tehran. It extends from Imam Khomeini Square to 15 Khordad Street in Tehran's Bazaar District. Along the way are some of the most iconic buildings and places of the capital, such as Darul Funun School, Saray Roshan, Shamsul Emare Building, and Marvi Alley. Nasser Khosrow is more than just a street. You just need to walk from one end to another in order to travel to the past without even leaving the present. Join me in this historic journey.
The construction of Nasser Khosrow Street dates back to 1906. Before that date, the street was part of a large ditch in this area. After the construction of new trenches, they filled the ditch and it became Nasiriyye Street, because it was built by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar.
The best way to know the central part of a city is to visit its historical places. Darul Funun School, the first modern school of Iran, which was founded in 1851 by Mirza Taqi Khan Amir Kabir.
Muhammad Taqi Amir Nizam, known as Amir Kabir, was the prime minister of Iran during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. During his time, Amir Kabir exercised administrative programs, cultural and economic reforms for the country. And certainly, his most important work was the foundation of Darul Funun. Darul Funun School played a major role in the process of modernization of Iran. Continue our journey on the road to the south. It is interesting that the first pharmacy, the first printing press, and the first school of Iran were all in this street. In its central section, most buildings date back to the early 20th century, and some of these historical buildings have been preserved.
Towards the middle of the Nasser Khosrow Street, Saray Roshan rises as a historical symbol of this area, one of the first commercial buildings of the capital city. Its unique style is inspired by Gothic architecture.
Only 2 to 3 minutes walk from Saray Roshan, we find another unique building, which is called Shamsul Emare.
In this street, you can enjoy the architecture of a building called Shamsul Emare, or the Edifice of the Sun. Shamsul Emare is one of the most impressive structures of the Golestan Palace, which was built around 150 years ago by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar,
I'm sure he had a perfect view of the city of Tehran when he was standing up there.
Shams al-Emare is the first five-story building in the capital, and at the time was considered the tallest building in Tehran. The building combines traditional Iranian architecture with European one. The facade of this building is decorated with bricks and colorful tiles with some beautiful paintings.
The famous Marvi Alley is located right across the street to Shams al-Emare building. Here you can find many different shops and boutiques for all different tastes and budgets. This part of the market attracts tourists and customers from different socioeconomic levels.
Marvi School is located in the same alley, and it is one of the oldest seminaries in Iran. This school was built almost about 200 years ago. The Marvi School is a 4,500 square meters space and has a capacity for about 200 students. The schoolyard is a square garden and it includes several rooms, a library consisting of old books, and a small pond in the middle. Before I say goodbye to this street, I'm going to try some street food here because Tehran's Bazaar district is famous for its tasty foods. I was told that the falafel sandwich of this area is just awesome. And indeed it is, so I hope you get a chance to try it too. Shahriyar Azimi for Iran.
Tehran is a megacity with a population of around 13 million people. It's a modern city with a modern architecture. Flats and high-rise buildings rule the whole city. From the outside, it's quite dense and all the houses look the same. But from the inside, well, let's go and see what makes the architecture of some of the buildings quite different from the rest. Some of the architects in the country, building a structure is not just about keeping up with the latest architectural trends. It's more about building a house that adapts with the functional needs of its users. Let's take a look at this one.
This is the Sharifiha house, a flexible structure with three turning boxes or rooms that can be rotated 90 degrees to open up the terrace during hot summers and turn back to a horizontal position to keep the house warmer during the cold, snowy winters. Ali Taghabouni is the mastermind behind the creation. He was inspired by the country's traditional houses, which offered both a winter and a summer living room for the residents.
We're going to see another house. It's basically a childhood dream come true. An eco-friendly house that will certainly blow your mind away.
A portable house made from wood and built in just 3 days. 72 pieces to be precise. 36 parts for the roof and 36 for the body, all fastened with screws. It's not one of the usual houses that you see each day. It's a house that connects you to nature and makes you feel calm and restful, undisturbed from the outside world. Abbas Iftikhari is the architect of this house, who has been living here with his family ever since it was built. He has studied industrial design, restoration of historic monuments and interior design, and he has been teaching them all in the university for 18 years. Mr. Iftikhari told me that wood is a naturally grown and engineered material which contributes to an overall removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. At the same time, it's structurally strong and acts as a natural insulator due to the air pockets within its cellular structure. The family's sun clock was also interesting to see. Mr. Iftikhari explained to me that as the sun moves across the sky, the shadow aligns with different hour lines which are marked on the dial to indicate the time of the day. Every nook and corner of the house was also filled with different wooden sculptures, and as we understood, Abbas Iftikhari has a hand in sculpting too.
It's a dreamy experience, rubbing your hands on the different shapes of wood and smelling the woody fragrance and looking at the colorful, delicate veins as they each tell you their life story.
We live in a world constantly surrounded by technology. Maybe it's about time we got in touch with Mother Nature, becoming environmentally aware and reconnecting with the energy of the universe. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you for joining us. The situation in Syria remains the primary focus of Hebrew media after the events in Suwayda, alongside the stalemate in the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli dispute surrounding the crisis of drafting the Haredim. We discuss these topics on today's episode with Dr. Mohammed Suwaydan, academic and writer in international affairs, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohammed. Syria remains at the center of Hebrew media attention as Israeli analysts and commentators express their views about what has happened and what may happen in Syria. Some of them call for no agreements to be made with President Sharaa, whom they described as Julani. Why would some Israelis do not want to normalize with Syria, despite the Syrians' gesture towards the Israelis? Is it because of what happened with the Jews, or there are other reasons?
First of all, it's important to emphasize that I think it's one of the rare moments in history where a certain country wants to normalize relations with another one,
yeah,
while the other one is always bombing it and occupying its land. So the whole situation is really weird in this case. But the reason is mainly it's not about Druze. Israel doesn't care about Druze.
Yes.
It doesn't care about anyone.
It only cares, it as a pretext.
Exactly. It only cares about its own interests.
Okay.
But who doesn't want to normalize with Syria is all of Israel. It's not the only some analysts, even Netanyahu, even the cabinet, doesn't prefer normalizing.
But I don't understand why, Dr. Muhammad.
It's mainly,
as you highlighted, it's a good gesture. Maybe that will, is it because they will not be able to expand the buffer zone, as the commentator highlighted, a few kilometers front?
It's for several reasons. So it's reason number one, it's because Israel will always search for a reason to expand its territory. So part of expanding its territory is inside of Syria, especially in the south of Syria, since it's the border with occupied Palestine.
Okay.
So it doesn't need to, Israel doesn't need to go to an agreement with Syria that forbids it from occupying parts of Syria, number one. And number two, it's because Israel doesn't trust the people today in power in Syria. It also views them as militias, terrorists, that may at a certain point return to having some operations against Israel. So it doesn't trust them. So what it needs, what it's emphasizing for, mm-hmm. is a normalization agreement with Syria, but giving it a lot of its interests. Part of them was the Golan Heights. Part of them was the south, all the south of Syria. Mm-hmm. Part of them not having Turkey, some military bases inside of Syria. Mm-hmm. So it's mainly like having returning colonialism over Syria.
Yes.
Israel is having it at occupying parts of it.
Okay, but again, they have a golden chance to be allies against Iran. Mm-hmm. And taking into consideration also that Al-Qaeda and ISIS never hit Israel.
Yes,
it's kind of confusing when it comes to that.
It's true, but this is not how Israel thinks. Netanyahu have always spoken about, and he said it in his books, that in relations with the Arab states, only power is the language to use. So they don't believe in the language of peace. They don't believe in the language
because
of
obviously they want to expand. That's only that's the only case they're seeing.
They want to return for the greater Israel, which Syria is part of. So normalizing maybe blocks this. This plan, so they need to expand every phase alone. That's why they prefer to still use power. They think that when they use power, when they destroy the Syrians' military bases, then they will force Syrians towards normalization in the conditions they prefer most.
Yes, okay. What the Israeli entity wants in Syria is only to entrench the occupation of southern Syria and turn it into a demilitarized zone. Everything said about protecting the Jews in Suwayda or elsewhere is meaningless, according to the former deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army. Doesn't such remarks divide or to dissect Syria? It's very painful, and it's like that's exactly what many analysts are analyzing. That's the plan that they're going towards. And now speaking, looking at this report,
you know, the ironic thing is that nothing is hidden. If you read Israeli official statements, if you read Israeli books from the establishment of Israel in 1948 till now, and if you read these since the beginning of the 20th century, when the idea of creating Israel, establishing Israel, was negotiated, since that point, everyone spoke about the greater Israel. Everyone spoke about how Israel has a plan to divide the countries near it, and everyone speaks about how Israel always wants to occupy new lands. So it's all written. Nothing is hidden. It's all written that Israel has no allies, Israel has no friends, Israel doesn't care about anyone in the region, rather than its own interests. And Israel will continue working on dividing the countries in the region,
so they can
and occupying
expand.
Exactly, and occupying the lands of the countries in the region. So this is written.
But seemingly, Turkey shares the same interest.
You know, the difference between Turkey and Syria is that Turkey is a regional power that has a long history in the region. It's a country that has its own land, its own history, and everything. Israel is an entity which was created in order to expand. Mm. So we have a huge difference between Israel and Turkey. Yes, Turkey at the same
point. But it's for its own benefit for Syria to be divided.
I don't think it's a benefit for Syria to be divided. It's what regional powers want. That Turkey needs part of it. Israel needs part of it. And that's not even a benefit for the Syrian people. For the Syrian people, most important interest is to have the whole of Syria liberated. That's not what's happening today. Every day that passes on, parts of Syria are occupied, mm-hmm. in the south or in the north. It doesn't matter, but parts of Syria are missing. And these parts of Syria are very important to the country on the economic level and on the political level. And that's what the Syrians are paying the price to do so. And let's see how Israel reacted to the Druze issue. It left,
they are the protector of the Jews.
Yes,
now.
It left. Yesterday I saw a number, more than 750 people were killed in the south of Syria. And this is while Israel is protecting them. So no one believes today that Israel really is protecting anyone. Everyone today knows that.
For the first time we ever heard that Israel is trying to protect any minority in any country. However, wouldn't this fact